Good morning and welcome to the local news hour on KPCW. It's 8:06. I'm Michelle Deininger filling in for Leslie Thatcher. And on the phone with us to start our week is meteorologist Thomas Guiboy from ABC4 Weather with details on the week's forecast. Good morning, Thomas.
Oh, good morning to you. I hope that your Monday's off to a good start. And I think weather-wise, it's going to be... Yeah, so I think weather-wise, it's going to be a very nice day, and I think it's going to be a good idea for anybody to get outside and enjoy today, because after today, we're going to be going on a little bit of a roller coaster with our weather up in Park City. So right now in Park City, we're sitting around 43 degrees. Meanwhile, in Heber, it's sitting at 32. So there are some chilly spots out there, probably going to want at least a sweater, maybe a jacket as you're heading out the door. But we'll be finding temperatures around 70 degrees this afternoon in Park City, so it is going to be a beautiful day under a mostly sunny sky, but during the second half of the day, clouds will start to gradually increase. And you'll notice that cloud coverage increasing from late this afternoon into tonight as we go to a mostly cloudy sky with an overnight low of around 47 degrees. So tomorrow we start off on the partly sunny, mostly cloudy side of things. We'll find a temperature of 69 degrees by tomorrow afternoon. So the temperature tomorrow not going to be too far off of what we're going to find today. But by the second half of the day, afternoon, we will add a 40% chance for showers. So that rain chance will be increasing tomorrow and the cloud coverage will be increasing as moisture works its way in from the south. And I think the best chance of rain is going to be from Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, where we see the rain chance go from 40% tomorrow afternoon to 70%, and we'll see the overnight low dropping to 46. So with the moisture moving in, we're also going to start to find some cooler temperatures as well. On Wednesday, the high temperature only 60 degrees. We're still going to keep the chance for showers in the forecast, still looking more likely than not for Wednesday at a 60% chance. Temperature drops to 45 degrees for Wednesday night into Thursday morning. The rain chance drops to 40 to 50%, and we're going to keep that chance for showers in the forecast through Thursday with a daytime high of 62 degrees. And then we could see temperatures cool down even further from that, as the chance of rain is not going to go away. It doesn't look to be quite as likely for the second half of the week, but it still will be a possibility Thursday night into Friday. And Friday, the daytime high, only 53 degrees. And we'll be looking at daytime highs for both Saturday and Sunday in the lower to middle 50s. Meanwhile, the overnight low will go from 44 on Thursday night down to around 35 degrees Saturday night. And with the chance for showers at this point, can't completely rule out the chance that we could see some flurries. But it looks like maybe just a little bit higher up than Park City. That looks to be a little bit more of a possibility. But overall, we're going from a warm day, warm and sunny day today, to cooler temperatures and also higher rain chances for the rest of the week, Michelle.
All right. Thanks so much. Good to know. Let's get into some headlines. Park City resident and former city council candidate Michael Franchek has filed a federal lawsuit against Park City and four police officers. He's charging that during a confrontation 2 years ago, he and his son were threatened, assaulted, and deprived of their rights. Rick Bruff has more.
The suit names the city and the four officers. The Park City Attorney's Office said in a statement that the city has not been served, which is the next step in the litigation, and the city has no comment. The suit was filed September 27th, nearly 2 years ago to the day after the altercation with the police. Franchek told KPCW that he filed within the statute of limitations applying to the case, but he added that he had the right to file litigation at a time of his choosing.
I've made numerous attempts over the years to resolve this amicably with Park City, but they're completely uninterested. As a matter of fact, they've been, you know, just downright very, very, very difficult. Throughout this process,
the federal court filing said that on September 29th of 2019, two officers came to Franchek's home in Park Meadows, reportedly responding to a call about a verbal dispute between neighbors. Franchek said he greeted them amicably at his door, but when he asked the officers to identify themselves in accordance with city policy, one officer allegedly became angry and screamed at Franchek to exit his home. Franchek said he became fearful for his safety and shut the door. The officers, he said, then broke into his home and assaulted him. After willingly walking out the door, Franchek said he was tased by the officer and was placed in a hot police car with no air conditioning. He also alleges that his son was calmly recording the altercation on video, but another officer arriving on the scene struck out at the teenager and tried to stop the recording. Franchek said that he and his son sustained minor bruising, but both of them suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome as a result of the incident. He said that his son is now terrified at the sight of policemen. Franchek is asking for a written and verbal apology from the city and wants over $900,000 in compensatory, punitive, and medical damages. He filed the lawsuit as his own attorney, but he said he is well-prepared and experienced in that role.
I'm extremely well-versed in the law. If you look at my record over the years, you only have to Google me to see the cases that I've been involved in and that I've been successful in on the federal level with the Department of Defense, with the state of California, that I've won. I recently won roughly $1.5 million in a federal lawsuit.
He said he has some surprises for the city ahead in the litigation. Franchek said the basic reason for his conflict with Part City is optics.
We have a reputation of being this wonderful, beautiful city that hosted the Olympics. We're the host of Sundance Film Festival. We're the playground of some of the rich and famous, arguably one of the most beautiful cities in the state of Utah or in the Mountain West. And the city will stop at no means to protect its reputation. And what happened in my case is, it's in my filing. There's some good cops. I don't have a beef with Wade Carpenter. We have this kind of on-again, off-again relationship, but I think he's probably a decent guy.
Franchek said the altercation opened his eyes and he became a candidate this year for Part City Council. Although he lost in the primary, Franchek said he thinks his campaign themes of accountability and transparency caught the attention of the public. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Coming up, I have got Megan Lewis, a professor from the USU Extension, talking about the science behind leaf peeping. I've also got filmmaker Holly Tuckett talking about her new documentary about female wildland fighters. And I've got Rob Harder from the Christian Center talking about what that organization is working on as we head into holidays and winter. First, let's get to another local story. It's time to kick off the winter sports season here, and people are thinking about gear. The annual Park City Ski Swap will be back with a room full of it again early next month. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has this.
The sale will take place November 5th through 7th at the Basin Recreation Fieldhouse on Center Drive in Park City. That follows the donation period, when people can drop off their old items from November 1st through 4th at Jan's Outfitters and Cole Sport, both located on Park Avenue. Organizers will accept gear between 1 and 7 years old. Tickets are on sale now to give access to the 3-day sale. The new ticket system will have people wait in a staging tent next to the field house. Shoppers will have about 90 minutes to get their gear. Park City Ski and Snowboard Events and Development Director Pete Stoughton says that shouldn't deter anyone who may have a crew to shop for, though.
Well, you certainly don't want to rush people. We'll have wristbands and we'll be able to manage, you know, waves of people as they come in and out. It takes time to bring in your kids and put on the boots and try everything out. So while we would love for people to take about 90 minutes and our checkout process will be a lot faster this year, at the same point in time, if someone's actually shopping and legitimately doing that, then great.
Shoppers must wear masks inside. Whereas the record capacity was just under 1,900 once, they'll be capped at 500 this year. Hours are 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday, and 10 to 2 on Sunday. Tickets cost $15 for Friday, $10 for Saturday, and $5 for Sunday. Stoughton says tickets for Friday or Saturday might grant re-entry on Sunday, but that's yet to be confirmed. Items available won't cover all needs, but many essentials.
Well, and because we're covering all of the divisions now, there could be backcountry gear, there could be, so any of those hard goods. So we are accepting those, as well as helmets, but not goggles. And so mainly predominantly hard goods.
The swap's a fundraiser for Park City Ski and Snowboard, which provides ski and snowboard training programs. Stoughton says after missing a year because of COVID-19, the event's especially important this year for program funding.
Park City Ski and Snowboard is growing significantly. We're seeing growth in all of our programs. Record registrations double the participation from previous years. And so all of the programs need that support. And 30% of all of our expenses are covered by fundraisers just like the Ski Swap. So it's a huge component of our fundraising. And last year we were not able to do it. So we're kind of crawling back up out of that.
For tickets or more information, visit parkcityskiswap.com or parkcityss.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Let's talk leaf peeping. The last couple of weeks, the intensity of the leaves changing color has been unusually spectacular. On the phone with us to talk about why the fall show is so great right now is Megan Lewis. She's an associate professor with the USU Extension. She works in Summit and Wasatch counties, and she's going to explain the science behind the scenes we're seeing in nature. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in. First of all, before you explain what's happening out there, people seem to believe and be talking about how this year was supposedly going to be a very brown, boring leaf year. Why did people even think that, or was that just an unfounded rumor?
Yeah, so we've had just a really extreme drought this year, and even just walking through the forest and seeing trees in our yard, they've already had just kind of brown, damaged leaves. And usually when that happens, our fall colors end up looking really dim and brown. We don't have a lot of that red, orange, yellow color. So we're all pretty surprised when the colors were very intense and fiery this year. But I can get into the science about it and kind of explain how we kind of hypothesize what the colors will look like, but how we can't always perfectly determine it either.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to hear about that. So you're saying people thought it was going to be a brown year because some leaves turned brown early due to drought.
Yes. Yeah, anytime we have low water levels, we typically have those brown leaves.
Okay, so everybody was wrong. Let's hear about why the colors have been so vivid and intense this year.
Yeah, so, well, there's a couple different reasons. So my first guess is that we had that late, really heavy rainfall in August, and I'm wondering if that kind of energized the trees a little bit and help them to have those brighter colors.
So that's one hypothesis. Let's talk about a little bit more of the science on why they start turning when we get to a certain temperature and are doing what we've been watching the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, so leaves, they kind of have a genetic reason for turning. So maples will always be red, orange, or yellow. Aspens are typically yellow and green, and within that you can see some slight variation, and that's just based on genetics. But all of our leaves start to change in fall for one main reason, and that's because our day length is shortening. That is the automatic trigger that tells the leaves that they need to start going dormant. So as part of the dormancy process to prepare for winter, they lose a lot of the chloroplast in their leaves, which is that green pigmentation. So as it breaks down, there's another pigment called carotenoids that have a yellow hue, and those start to be visible. So you can really see that in the aspens. They turn that yellowy golden color. You can see it in the maples as well. But also, as our temperatures start to get colder in the fall, a new pigment starts to develop called anthocyanin, and that's where you see the pink, red, purple that you see in a lot of the maples. Even the dogwoods have kind of more of a purple color too. So that one is the one that really varies from year to year. Every year we see that traditional golden yellow color, and that's because it's present all year round. It's just masked by the green pigments. So those really start to pop out in the fall, but those reds, those are really developed when we have warm, sunny days in fall and then those cool, crisp nights. So we've had a absolute gorgeous fall. It's been really warm and sunny during the day, but it has been dropping colder at night. But we also haven't had our traditional really early frost this year either. So if we have an early frost, that can really damage the leaves and cause them to turn brown early. So because we had a later frost, we've really been able to drag out this color with those bright pinks, reds, and purples.
So it was interesting to hear you say that the light is a trigger for trees. Probably most people understand that the weather triggers, but the light too. It's like the secret life of trees, right? They're taking cues from nature that are a lot more complicated than people realize.
Yeah, and I think most plants rely on day length because that's the one that is fairly constant every year. If they did rely on weather, then they would have a lot more damage. So day length is usually the number one factor, whether it's flower production or the leaves changing color, all those different things. So when it relies on day length, that constant element, then it can protect itself from damage of cold temperatures, basically.
So why do some trees have a portion yellow and a portion green, say with the aspens? Are they just in progress?
Yes. So a lot of trees, they have just differences throughout the canopy. So some areas might be greener or more yellow. That's just because they might have a different speed of a process for each leaf. Some leaves might have been damaged, or the stem may have been damaged, so they're turning yellow earlier because they've already had less chlorophyll throughout the year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, meaning that, that drought-stressed trees are going to start their process more quickly because they're trying to protect themselves. Is that it?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So the aspens, it has absolutely nothing to do with where they're located, which way they face, how much sun exposure they have. Probably some people have noticed this. You can see a row of them, and they're just doing different things.
Yes, yeah, so that is fairly common. Typically, they all change. You know, you'll go up to the mountains, and they'll be kind of the same colors as they are down in the canyons, and that's due to the daylight effect. But you also do have differences between nutrient content, water levels, all those different factors throughout the year that have affected how many chloroplasts are in the leaf. So if they have more chloroplasts in the leaf, they'll stay green longer versus losing it earlier in the year. So exposing those yellow pigments earlier just because they've had, you know, less nutrition or water levels throughout the year.
And we're pretty much at the end of the cycle, right? I mean, not completely, but we're past peak, wouldn't you say?
Yes, definitely. Definitely had a couple of hard frosts lately that have really knocked the leaves off. And just as part of the cycle, trees kind of, they create these cells where the leaf connects to the branch, and they basically break off their own leaves just to protect themselves, because if those leaves are staying on the tree for too long, then they can pull a lot of nutrients from the tree. But what we want to do is push all of those nutrients down into the root. So they're basically protecting themselves. It really wouldn't benefit the tree to have the leaves on any longer. So they're just trying to knock them all off. And of course, if we have any bursts of wind that knock them off, or rainstorms, any of that will help to kind of knock all those leaves off for the year. But we're definitely at the end.
So interesting. So your work must be fun. You teach horticulture, urban gardening, or urban farming and gardening. So the outdoors is your office. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so I work over in Summit and Wasatch County at Kettlewolf, but I do teach a lot of gardening classes. We're basically, we have an extension faculty in every county, and they take research-based information from the university, and we make it available to the public, whether it's through classes or different publications we put out. And this month I'm doing houseplant classes in both counties. We'll be doing a weed identification and management class and a soil health class as well. So people can check out our websites, just Summit Extension or Wasatch County Extension, either one, and they can look up more information about classes and other information that we offer.
Okay, and then more broadly, the Extension's website says it's geared toward providing research-based programs and resources with the goal of improving the lives of individual families and communities, which sounds great. Can anybody sign up for horticulture classes with you? And are they year-round?
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah. I offer classes every month, about 3 to 4 classes a month. Most of those are free. If there is a fee, then it's just to cover the cost of materials, but most of them really are free, and we are here just to help the community and to help them better their lives in all sorts of ways.
Thank you for your time. That's so interesting. I appreciate it. Is there anything else we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about?
I think we covered all the basics.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Megan Lewis, associate professor with the Utah State University Extension. And as you may have heard her say, classes are free and they're geared to the community. For more information about those, you can go to extension.usu.edu. Well, joining me right now is local filmmaker Holly Tuckett. She has a new documentary out called Anchor Point, and she is going to discuss it. And then joining us shortly by phone is Kelly Martin, retired chief of fire and aviation for Yosemite National Park. She is in the film and is going to call in by phone and talk about it. Good morning, Holly. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us here.
Kelly, can you hear me?
Hi, Michelle. I'm on too. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Yes, I can. Thanks.
Okay, perfect.
All right, so let's talk about the film. I have questions for both of you. Holly, let's start with you. How did you come to this project, and how long has it been in the works?
In 2018, a firefighter over the summer that was interested in pursuing some sort of documentary because she was working for the BLM at the time and had collected a lot of data in her position about women and EEO complaints about harassment on the fire lines. And she herself was also being kind of targeted in her station. And but she blew the whistle too soon for us to get in and really do anything with her and working with the BLM. And so it kind of made getting permissions to be on fire lines and things like that very difficult. But she did connect us with another woman who knew about this program called Women in Prescribed Fire Training Exchange. And she was like, this is going to be the place where you will be able to be on an active fire line, and it won't be as difficult to gain access to women and women's stories. And she said, these women are amazing and you should totally connect with them. And so that's kind of where things began in following Kelly and Lacey England's stories, is meeting them at WTREX.
You're working to end gender discrimination and harassment in that field. Kelly, would you want to share any particular anecdotes that might have spurred you to take on this role of advocate, or are there too many to recount?
And I think when you spend an entire career, you know, devoted to working for a public land management agency and working for the public and the taxpayers, I just really felt a higher calling that said, you know, we're better than this, and the public deserves better than this, and they really need to know a peek behind the curtain as to what are some of the pitfalls that women feel in a predominant male-dominated environment. And so anyway, so that was part of my reasoning for coming forward in 2016 when I testified before Congress about misconduct and mismanagement in our public land management agencies. So I really wanted to bring light to it, knowing that we have the capability to become better parts of ourselves.
So Holly, in all your research and the difficulties you encountered getting people to talk, do you feel like you got as many stories as you wanted?
I got the exact stories that I wanted, actually. You know, one thing that I really learned in coming to WTREX and being a part of this week-long camping experience and being with these women on the fire line is that they really don't want the focus to be on them being victims. They want the focus to be on how they do the work that they do. And their hope is that, you know, the things that they're trying to do in changing the culture of fire from within, from the ground up, rather than from the top down, that is going to help retain women in the fire service. And so for me, Kelly and Lacey just were kindred spirits of a different generation. I kind of saw them as the same person, but with very different approaches to how they were, approaching their career and dealing with the sexism and the harassment that sometimes they faced. And I thought it would be an interesting look at this two-generational way of navigating a very male-dominated environment so that people can really understand the different ways that women approach the work that they do when they work with men. And so it really, really, I really feel like I found the best people to help me tell this story in a way that doesn't hit people over the head. I think people a lot of times are expecting something very different when they come to see the movie. They walk away with a very different perspective than when they walked through the doors to see it. So, yeah, I feel like I got the right people for the right movie.
So there's a perception that men make more powerful firefighters due to their physical size. And the trailer for your movie has a pretty impactful anecdote that counters that, which I cannot quote due to language restrictions on broadcast, but we can send people over to the site to look at the trailer. But would you both talk about what you've learned that counters that perception that men just simply must be better? How about Kelly, if you start?
Yeah, I think the first bar, if you will, is physical fitness. And that goes for women, too. And the ability for women to join the ranks that we're seeing right now in sports, in at universities and colleges and professional sports, they're there. And so we get very, very physically fit, agile, endurance athletes that apply as wildland firefighters, and that includes women. So that's not necessarily a point or an attribute that cancels women out, because they are just as agile and physically fit as men. Maybe not as strong, and so you've got to just really be able to balance those attributes because it's not just one thing. It's not just a bench press or push-ups, that really says that you're the most physically fit for this job. We know that there's men that aren't even physically fit for the job. So they're there, they can do it, and that's the least of our worries. But it does become a competition, if you will. We're all in competition with each other when we're coming up through the ranks. And so I think that's been one of the greatest disappointments is that, I know that when I was in my 20s and 30s, I was very physically fit for a very arduous job. But it was really all these, death by a thousand paper cuts and the bullying and the oppression and the, lack of recognition that really undermines our self-confidence and our ability to do the job. So those are some of the highlights that I think Holly really picked up on very, very well, that yes, there's tremendous amount of women that can come in and physically do this job. It's once they get in, what are the other oppressive factors, besides physical fitness that really can push women away and have them drop out.
Yeah, I would agree with Kelly on that. I think for women, it becomes once they get into the fire service, staying there is, do they have the mental fitness to put up with some of the things that they're going to encounter? And so that is something that you have to consider when you're entering this field. I do think it's changing. I do think we're on a path to making change. The U.S. Forest Service, actually, because of the fact that we've been on the festival circuit and it's been online, a lot of Forest Service employees have seen the film, and actually we're in negotiations right now to give them an educational copy of the film to use in their training.
All right. I should have mentioned this sooner. I'll mention it now, that Anchor Point is going to be showing at the Santee Theater in Park City October 7th at 7 p.m. And the screening is a fundraiser and is going to include a post-film Q&A. It sounds like you've got a few people lined up for the discussion. Do you want to talk about what people can expect with the showing?
Yeah. So we'll be showing the film, and it is a fundraiser. We're raising funds for a scholarship program for the Women in Prescribed Fire Training Exchange Program. We want to help send more women to this fundamental and very life-changing training. I think it gives women that are in the fire service a network of other women that they can bond with. They oftentimes are alone on the fire line with, 10, maybe sometimes 15 other men, and they don't encounter other women as they work. So we want to be able to raise funds. So that'll be a 10-minute paddle drive, basically fast and furious, to raise money. And then right after that, we'll watch the movie, we'll do the paddle drive, and then basically spend some time getting to know Kelly Martin, Lacey England, and also Lenya Quinn Davidson, who is the head of the Women in Prescribed Fire Training Exchange.
All right, Kelly, I wanted to come back to some more of your work. You're also the president of the Grassroots Wildland Firefighters Committee, whose mission is to advocate for proper classification, pay, benefits, and comprehensive well-being of all wildland firefighters. Do you want to talk a little bit about that organization?
Sure. We're a new nonprofit, 501c3, and a couple of years ago, we recognized the gaps in our ability to really leverage reforms from the inside. And most people feel that if they really try to push too hard for reforms, they become an outcast and are retaliated against. And so several of us, as we were nearing retirement and retired and resigned firefighters, we said, we have to give voice to firefighters for these reforms. We are working in an antiquated system that was developed 50 years ago, and we really have not been able to rise up and meet the challenge of increased effects of large wildfires due to climate change, increasing field loading, increasing population, and we're having significant issues with mental health crisis with wildland firefighters because of the immersion that they are in 24/7 year after year. And we just saw that, we just came out of another really dreadful year in 2021, and it started in 2020. And so firefighters have been going at it now for almost 24 months. So we really felt that we needed a strong advocacy group to contact elected officials in Congress to really help them view and understand the changes that need to occur, because it's been so difficult working within the system. We just said, we really need to educate the public and the elected officials for the reforms that need to change. So we do have language in the infrastructure bill, the current infrastructure bill that increases pay. Starting pay for wildland firefighters is $13.45 an hour. So the Biden administration did say, made good on the promise that all firefighters would minimally make $15. It's still woefully short of making a living wage, and so we're still pushing for an increase in wage and then proper classification, because we're not considered emergency responders. We are not considered for presumptive health care coverage. That is so important that people end up, getting sick or injured or have cardiovascular and heart and lung disease when they later on in their career. So anyway, we're gaining a lot of traction. We've got a lot of really great support, and thanks for asking about that, because we're pretty excited about the work that we're doing and the reception that we're getting from the public and the elected officials.
Sounds like you have a lot of very important goals. And we need our firefighters cared for as fire seasons are getting longer and more dangerous, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So, Holly, how should people get their tickets to the Santee?
You basically can go to parkcityfilm.org and look for Anchor Point the film Anchor Point, and you can buy your tickets there right online. There are going to be COVID protocols in place, so we've limited the number to make it so that social distancing can take place within the theater. We're hoping to see as many people as we can to come and partake with us and really get to know what it's like to be a wildland firefighter. I think we take a peek into the life of a wildland firefighter from a very different perspective than most movies that have been made.
Sounds very intense. Thank you both. Is there anything else you want to mention that I didn't ask about?
Not that I can think of right now. Kelly, you?
I'm just grateful that, Holly has produced this documentary to, give us a really in-depth look at, not just women and gender, discrimination, but really the whole of the organization, the whole of our career. There's so many good people that are working, in this profession. And it really does kind of show, how important this work is for the public. So I'm really grateful for that, that it kind of, for me, serves a dual purpose that, yes, we need gender equality in the federal workforce, but it's also helping the public understand, what does a wildland firefighter do, and why is this so important for the public to know and understand? So mm-hmm. I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful for the communication this morning in our interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time, both of you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it being here.
Thank you, Michelle.
That was filmmaker Holly Tuckett and Kelly Martin, who's in the film, talking about Tuckett's new documentary, Anchor Point, which will show at the Santee this Thursday night, and will also include a post-film discussion with Tuckett and others. Tickets are at parkcityfilm.org. Joining us in the studio now is Rob Harder, Executive Director of Christian Center of Park City. Thanks for coming in, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So we are going to talk about upcoming events and things on your calendar as we approach a new season. Your work is obviously very important year-round. It feels most acutely needed in the winter. Does it feel that way to you?
It does. It's interesting, though, as the seasons have kind of changed in terms of people coming to Park City, we've seen the same, where it used to be kind of these dips in the off-season. We've kind of seen that flatten out a bit. Now, again, COVID's a bit different. That changed everything, but normally, winter is a very busy season, but we've seen summer to become just as busy. And so fall is probably one of the very rare times where it just dips a little bit, Michelle, but not too much.
But coming up, temperatures are dropping, and that brings a whole new set of concerns to you and all of the work you do. You've got a list of things to go over that we can be watching for, starting with the upcoming winter coat drive, which you hope will serve 1,000 kids. Is that right?
Exactly. A little history. So we do our Operation Hope every year, and actually about 6 years ago, we'll give out winter coats to every kid and every family that got involved. But we're getting calls from teachers telling us that, about now, all the way through October, right, the temperature starts changing, and the teachers were telling us that there was kids standing at the bus stop freezing, right, without a jacket, and so they needed the jackets now. They couldn't wait till December when we did our Operation Hope program. So we turned that around about 6 years ago, and it is a coat drive now that we would like to aim for 1,000 kids, and then what happens is the families sign up for Operation Hope, and then they get their coat when they sign up.
All right, and so for people who want to participate, what do they need to know about donating coats?
Yeah, so if you want to participate, we are asking for brand new or gently used coats, because we really want to get these kids, either getting brand new or gently used. You could drop them off between now and November 1st is the deadline for the coat drive. So you've got all of October to drop that off at the Christian Center, again, Monday through Saturday, anytime. Just if you do drop it off in the back where you drop off normal, like furniture and other clothes, just make sure you say this is for the coat drive, because we separate those out from the other coats that are donated to just they go to our store.
Brand new or gently used, all sizes.
Correct, all sizes.
And for the people who are more newly arrived and don't know where to find you, let's tell them your address.
Absolutely. I'm glad you always asked that. Yeah, 1283 Deer Valley Drive, right on the corner of Deer Valley and Bonanza.
And then your hours of operation to accept the coats?
Yeah, you can come anytime between 10 and 3 p.m. 10 a.m. and 3 p.m.
Okay, great. All right, so what's next on your calendar for fall? You've got an anagram event.
Yes, the Enneagram. You know, we've been on the show before, but it's been a while, and we have had so much interest in this program. We're offering the Enneagram event again. Mary Wright is on staff with us, and she's really become an expert in this Enneagram inventory. It's a personality inventory, and this will be another, basically a 101 introduction. So if you've heard about it, you're curious about it, maybe people at your work or your family, someone has done it, we're going to offer that again. It'll be next Thursday night, and it'll be just a fun event to learn a little bit more about yourself, your personality, what makes you tick, and then what makes those people around you tick. So it's just an ability, if you will, to understand people better and understand yourself better.
Who can't benefit from that, right?
Exactly right. That's why it's so popular. It's such a fun event.
How long has that been going on?
So we've done that. I think this is the third year now we've provided that, because Mary Wright has been there for about 3 years.
And then how many people usually participate?
This is it. Oh, boy, it varies. We've had over 100 to we've had 25. So it really kind of varies, depends on the event. Now, this one, as I understand it, we will have both a Zoom option and a live option. So you can kind of decide what you're comfortable with.
Oh, all right. And then how do people sign up to participate in that?
Yeah, best is our website. Just go to ccofpc.org. And go to our counseling page. It should be on our main page too, but if you go to our counseling page, you'll see the Enneagram event there listed and featured.
All right, thanks. So what else do we need to know about? Holidays coming, annual drive for holiday food.
Exactly, Michelle. Yeah, so this is we're a month out, but I always like to prep people, and Deb Hartley will be glad that I'm bringing this up, because Deb has been, as we call it, the turkey queen for many, many years, meaning the turkey drive is coming, and this is by the Park City Board of Realtors and the philanthropic foundation, essentially, for the Park City Board of Realtors. They have done such a great job with this turkey drive. It has gotten so big, Michelle. This is actually the largest turkey drive in the entire state of Utah. So the generosity of Park City people in Summit County and Wasatch County, because this extends into Heber as well, of course, we will have so many turkeys that we'll be able to provide, not just for us and our two food pantries in Heber and Park City, but there'll be enough turkeys to spread it to many other food pantries throughout the state.
And so how do they calculate size of the drive? Is it food by weight?
You know, this one is just sheer number of turkeys.
Okay, number of turkeys. Do people need to donate anything else food-wise, or is it just the turkeys?
Just the turkeys. And the way they've set it up, and this works the best, I mean, you could always just donate a turkey, but the way they've set it up is they work with the market, you know, in town. Mm-hmm. And if you give money, essentially, we've already kind of pre-ordered a number of turkeys. And then as they get closer, we're able to, you know, purchase more. But Deb and the Park City Board of Realtors has worked it out where if you donate to them initially, then they will go purchase the turkeys, and then we go pick them up as the food pantry. And so that seems to be the best way to work, as opposed to buying turkeys and bringing them. They encourage you to actually purchase through them, and then they will go and purchase the turkeys at the market.
Sure, much more efficient.
Yeah, it just works easier that way.
Oh, I can imagine. Okay, and then other food drives as we get farther into the holidays?
Yeah, so this is a fun time because a lot of corporations, a lot of businesses, schools, in fact, the largest food drive is done by the National Honor Society at Park City High School, and that's a really fun thing because they have like competition between the different grades, and they try to out-compete each other in terms of getting food for those who are hungry. So it's a great cause. It's really fun, but I do encourage you, if you're thinking about something, or maybe you're listening and your business has not selected something to do, this is a great opportunity. And one of the things I've mentioned to Leslie before on the show is it's not just about a food drive, although that's critical. This is the time we depend on that, but a lot of people that come through our food pantry, they also need diapers, they need formula, they need feminine hygiene products, a lot of other things. So if you're interested in doing something beyond just a food drive, let us know. We can get you a list of things that we're always in need of and that our recipients really appreciate, and we'd be happy to give that list. And so maybe you do a diaper drive this year. That would be hugely helpful during these times where everything seems to be going up in price, and it really does hit our low-income community pretty hard.
So I think it bears repeating a couple of general guidelines for people to bear in mind as they plan to donate, such as check the expiration dates on foods, and you want to talk a little bit more about some of the things that you've seen that people need to be aware of so that their donations are
as useful as possible?
Yeah, that's a great point, Michelle. A couple of things. Number one, I would just say, what do you like to eat? Typically, if you like to eat and it's good quality, that's exactly what other people like to eat as well. Now, we are trying to be more culturally appropriate with everything we offer at our food pantry. And so there's things that you can ask us about, and we give you a list of things that people in our pantry like. But yes, to your point, definitely check the expiration date. This would not be a great time to clean out your basement or your cupboards and have these cans that are maybe 10 years out of date. That's not helpful, because there is an expiration eventually to this food, sadly. And so we really would ask, the more you can check that and be really intentional. And again, just think about maybe the best way I find is that when you go hot shopping, when you buy whatever you need for your family, buy an extra can or two, buy an extra diaper or two, just add to what you're buying that day. And that way, you know, it's fresh, it's, you know, current, and then donate that. I think that's just a great way, and to get your kids involved. We've gotten our kids over the years involved, and it's fun for them to get excited to say, hey, I want to buy this for somebody else. Yeah. And so that's a great way to expand it to your whole family.
All right. Let's talk about your Ethical Leadership Award. Congratulations on that. Can you tell us specifically, if you know, what drove your receipt of that? Do you know what criteria they used to determine that you were going to get this award?
You know, we don't 100%. They reached out to us and encouraged us to apply for this the award. And my guess is that I'm venturing a guess is that our reputation over the last 21 years, we just have always striven to have high integrity. Transparency is a really big deal to us. Getting audited every year financially is really important to us. We don't have to do that, but we choose to do that. Things like that, I think it just our reputation got out there. I think about our staff and how hard they work. And during this, I think specifically during COVID, we were able to really step up thanks to the community support too during this time where we gave out so much, you know, in terms of rent assistance and food and mental health. So I think that collectively got people's attention on a statewide level. And so they never told us exactly why, but we were so thankful. It really was, I think, one of the highest awards we've ever received, just because it's a recognition of our values in action and us, what we've tried to do the last 21 years. So we were so thankful.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's
it was
impressive.
Fun. As you said in your report earlier, Summit County has also got recognized, which was really fun. So that was fun to have two people representing Park City and Summit County at that statewide award.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, is there anything else that we need to touch on today that we haven't gotten through yet?
No, you've asked great questions. I would just encourage people to check out our website. There's always other things that I didn't get a chance to cover on our website. And, of course, to look at our Facebook page, too. And I know I gave a shout-out last month, but I continue to do that for volunteers. Always looking for more volunteers. And then as we have these food drives and have the different things that are coming on in terms of our programs, the coat drives, as I mentioned, always looking for volunteers. So you can go to our website again, ccofpc.org. Go to our volunteer page. It's a really easy process. We'd love to have you come volunteer whatever time makes sense and works with your schedule.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you, Michelle.
That was Rob Harder, Executive Director of Christian Center Park City. Quickly get into one more story. Google Maps will soon launch a new feature showing the location of active wildfires. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports on that.
Google says this new Maps filter will show where fires are burning and, when you click on it, will give emergency resources related to the fire. Vanessa Schneider's crisis response team worked on this at Google.
It's important to also kind of pair that geospatial information with things like emergency phone numbers, emergency websites, evacuation information. So whenever that information is available, we try to surface that within the Google Maps layer itself.
The filter will show major fires globally and smaller wildfires around the U.S. thanks to the National Interagency Fire Center. That Boise-based organization works with several governmental agencies to aggregate fire data. But Schneider says fires can move fast, so look to local officials when it comes to the latest information or evacuation orders. Expect the new feature to show up on filters in Google Maps in the coming weeks. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.